If it's happening in sports in Saskatchewan, we've got it covered. The all-new Sports Cage. Be part of the show. Call 936-6262 or toll-free 1-866-767-0620. On your radio at 620 CKRM and online at sportscage.com.
And welcome to Sports Cage. I'm Don Hewitt, and I'm joined, like I've been joined before, by Derek Bidwell in Saskatoon. Derek, a former Saskatoon Hilltop with decades of sports journalism experience. And before we go over the list of some outstanding guests we have today on Sports Cage, don't forget, Sports Cage is brought to you by Saskatchewan Lotteries, bringing communities together. Sask Lottery products fund over 12,000 sports, culture, and recreational groups across the entire province of Saskatchewan. And we'll start off with just a comment from yourself, if we can get one, Derek. And the question is, how did you feel? Were you impressed with the big announcement yesterday by Maz and Barney that Darren Durant is joining Sports Cage as a regular contributor?
Okay, keep talking, Don.
Okay, sorry there, Derek. We're just going through some technical difficulties, but I know you're as excited about Darren Durant joining the Sports Cage as much as I am that Darren Durant is joining Sports Cage. For some reason, I think I just called him Darren at the start. That's what technical difficulties will do. Throws you off kilter. But we've got a great set of guests on Sports Cage this afternoon. Right off the top, Brian Skirland, two-time Stanley Cup champion, will be on the Western Pizza Hotline. And there's so many things to talk about Brian Skirland about that it's almost endless, so we're really enjoying the opportunity to chat shortly to Brian. A little bit later, Arash Madani from Sportsnet will join us. Arash and Derek and I will talk about how insane it is that there's no cap in the NHL playoffs. It's just a loophole that's being taken advantage of hugely by the crafty general manager of the Vegas Golden Knights, and of course that's Kelly McCrimmon. Glenn Suter will be by after Arash, and we're going to ask him, why are teams paying quarterbacks 9-11% of their salary cap? Does that make any sense? Well, we're going to ask Glenn if it makes any sense. It's hard to say if it makes any sense. I'm saying no, but there's lots to discuss. The quarterbacks are the players that fans pay the money to watch. Jason Mannerty from getfishing.ca will be joining us about the start of the fishing season in Saskatchewan. We'll talk about South Saskatchewan lakes, North Saskatchewan lakes, and all the equipment, the tools, the advice, the know-how. Jason Mannerty knows fishing, he knows biology, he knows species, he knows brand names. If you have any interest at all in fishing, Jason Mannerty is your man, and we're going to hear from Jason at about 5 o'clock. Then our last guest around the 5:30 hour, 5:35, will be the play-by-play person of the Saskatchewan Rush, Cody Jansen, and we'll be talking to Cody about the end of the Rush season and a whole bunch of things about lacrosse, a lot of interesting things about lacrosse. It was interesting to look up the history of lacrosse. I think we've got you on the line now, Derek. You can hear us and everything?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
We can, and awesome. We can see you, at least in our control room. So we never got to the first question I wanted to throw at you there, Derek. That first question being, of course, Maz and Barney announcing Darren Durant as a regular contributor to Sports Cage. They announced it at 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. Darren Durant is really, really smart on football. He's a great articulator. Are you as jacked about Darren Durant as I am joining Sports Cage?
Yeah, you know what? That was a huge announcement, of course, Don. And I had a hunch
that it might be Darian Durant, because we here at Sports Cage are not holding anything back. We're trying to assemble the best team we can, of course. And when you think about having a former Rider on your squad to join another former Rider in Luke Mullinder, who's great at what he does as the color commentator, of course, for all our Rider broadcasts here on CKRM and on Cruise FM in Saskatoon. You talk about somebody else joining that group that's a former player, Darian Durant definitely comes to mind. So when I heard it was Darian Durant, I was very excited. And I listened to the cast with Maz and with Barney yesterday and listened to all the things he had to say about from the time he first found out that he was going to the Riders. At first, he thought he was going to Hamilton, and then he ended up going to the Riders, of course. Then his first training camp where he didn't dress appropriately when there was snow in May and he didn't have the clothes, and somebody else helped him out with some thicker stuff, I guess, to keep him warm. And then he, of course, advanced into how he developed such a strong relationship with Rider Nation and how it's the greatest football base in the Canadian Football League, of course, the best market for football in the Canadian Football League. So, yes, very excited that Darian Durant will be joining us here on Sports Cage every Monday at around 5 o'clock. Looking forward to hearing what he has to say as we get into the football season, get closer to training camp and get into the football season. And then talk about, of course, the Riders for the most part, but other things going on in the Canadian Football League with the other teams.
You bet. Well, Brian Skirtland joins us now on Sports Cage. He needs no introduction, but let's introduce him anyway. Brian grew up playing his minor hockey in Saskatoon, which led him to play for his hometown Blades of the Western Hockey League. Brian finished his junior career with 192 points. After winning a Calder Cup in the AHL with Sherbrooke, along with the Most Valuable Player Award in the playoffs, Brian jumped to the NHL with my favorite team, Montreal. As a money player his whole career, Brian was a force during Montreal's 1986 Stanley Cup playoff run, all ending up with the Habs' 23rd Stanley Cup victory. He would go on to play 8.5 seasons with the Canadiens, never missing the playoffs and being named assistant captain from 1989 to 92. Brian was later traded to the Calgary Flames during the 92-93 campaign before moving to the expansion Florida Panthers the following year. He would be named the first ever captain in Florida history and remain the captain there for four consecutive seasons. In 1997, he would sign with the New York Rangers and then later that year was traded to the Dallas Stars. In Texas, well, Brian won his second Stanley Cup ring in 1999 before transitioning to a coaching position with the Flames. All told, 881 NHL regular season games, compiling 124 goals, 219 assists, along with 1,170 penalty minutes. Brian has been inducted into the Saskatoon Sports Hall of Fame. That was in 08, and his number 10 jersey has been retired by the Blades. He's also going into the Sask Hockey Hall of Fame. You know, Brian, thanks for joining Derek and I on the Sports Cage. You know, it was nuts, absolutely nuts, that you were never taken in the NHL draft. Did that help push you throughout your NHL career?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's disappointment, and then there's the idea of trying to prove everybody else wrong, which I guess was my whole ordeal for my career. I had a pretty good couple years, couple last years there in Saskatoon, and was told that I was going to be drafted. I think that was the most disappointing thing, and that would be a real disappointment for today's player. I persevered. I thought there's people out there that I was better than, or at least as good as, wanted that opportunity. And when I did sign with the Montreal Canadiens, I will tell you, my general manager, coach Daryl Lubinicki at the time said, "Screwy, I don't know if you know this or not, but you're the furthest thing away from a flying Frenchman." I totally had to agree with them, yet at the same time, I thought they needed an English guy from out west to get them back over the hump.
Screwy, Derek Bidwell here in Saskatoon. First off, got to give you a quick hello from my brother-in-law, Kevin Killer Kaminsky, of course, former member of the Saskatoon Blades. He gives you a shout-out. I told him you're going to be on the show today, and he wanted to make sure that I did just that. Screwy, as everybody calls you, when did you feel that you made it? When did you feel that you belonged in the NHL? Obviously, you had a lot of success, as you mentioned. We're turning the clock back a little bit here before we talk a little bit more about your NHL career. But when you left junior hockey and you got into the NHL, at what point did you feel like, okay, this is going to be, I'm going to be here for a little while. I can make roots here in the NHL, and I feel like I can play this game, contribute at a high level, and do it maybe for a long time?
Well, to be honest with you, Derek, I had that opportunity of two full seasons in the American Hockey League, the first one coming in Halifax, Nova Scotia, the last year of the Nova Scotia Voyageurs, coached by a veteran coach, John Brophy at that time. Andre Boudreau was an assistant. Worked very well for me at that point in time. To be honest, I knew my skating wasn't up to what it should be to play at the NHL level. Never got a sniff for two full seasons, which I think I thank God for, because I think some guys get there, realize how hard they have to work. Some guys get there, realize, no, I'm just not going to make it, or get that thought in their head. The Canadians never even put that thought in my head. It was always positive feedback coming from the coaching staff, from upstairs. And then, you know, to do the thing that the Canadians were better than any team in the NHL for years, and that was winning. And getting an opportunity to spend some time with Serge Savard during our Calder Cup run in 84-85, realized how important winning truly is. And this is coming from a guy who really never won a lot growing up. So having that opportunity of winning that Calder Cup, having Serge Savard hang out with me for the entire evening, as he said, wherever that hardware goes, I go. So that hardware was in the captain's car, which was me at the time. So Serge and I had a heck of a time getting from place to place and enjoying each other's conversations. He did mention that if we, there were probably five or six of us that he planned on having on the club the following season as rookies. If we all came in good shape and were ready to go, which we did, as a matter of fact, instead of five or six, there were seven of us in total that went on to play our first year in the National Hockey League in 85-86. I personally was disappointed because I was wearing number 20 with the Sherbrooke Canadians when we won the Calder Cup. They traded Mark Hunter that summer. I thought, for sure, I'm going to get my number 20. And they picked up a kid from Sweden named Kjell Dahlin. And I thought, well, what the hell is this all about? Anyway, Kjell Dahlin went on to win Rookie of the Year. Was a huge part in us succeeding to win the Stanley Cup that year. And a quick little story about the Montreal Canadiens, but there was a fellow by the name of Toe Blake hanging around. Toe Blake, after each round, came up to me and kept saying, he'd go around the room, congratulations to everybody. When it came to me, he says, you haven't won anything yet. So that was the first round. Did the same in the second round. Did the same in the third round. Well, I was really curious, what is he going to say after we win this cup tonight? And we sure as heck did in Calgary, Alberta. And he came through that dress room, congratulations. And he finally said congratulations to me, but he said, that's only one. Well, I was 1-for-1 at that point in time in my career.
I thought
we were off to a pretty good start, but I think that was the epitome and the expectations of wearing that CH day after day. It was just all about winning.
Okay, well, now, Brian, we'll continue to talk a little bit about, you know, some of the history here of your career, because it is a very long and accomplished one, of course. Now, you win the Cup in 1986 with the Stanley Cup champions there, the Montreal Canadiens. Now, what was that like when you got back to Montreal? Because you won it on the road, you said, of course. And then what was it like when you got back to Montreal? Because I've only been in Montreal a couple of times, but I know Montreal can be a pretty good time around the St. Catharines area. Like, you know, I heard there's a lot of good times that could be had in the downtown area. That must have been one heck of a party when you got back. Must have been a great time.
Well, I was 22 years old. My wife and I were married. My wife, Lana, and I were married in Saskatoon the summer before the Stanley Cup, the summer after the Calder Cup. excuse me, fellas, and it was a thrill. I actually broke my jaw in game five, period one. Jamie McCallum broke my jaw. I knew something was truly wrong, but I thought, well, I'm not going to probably play a game six if there's one, so I better hang in there as long as I possibly can. I was fortunate enough to get my second goal of the playoffs in the second period, right off the post, right onto my stick. I had another 4x6, probably hit the post and put it in again. Anyway, that was a true thrill. But getting home that evening, my head felt like a cement truck. So I was, the jaw was pretty sore. The head was just so congested and full. But we walked through that airport. There were as many people in the airport as there were for our 99 Stanley Cup parade in Dallas. Let alone to mention when we did have that parade 3 days later in Montreal, there was over a million people from the City Hall all the way to the Forum. It was the most incredible day of my life. I wish I was in better shape for it, but at the same time, broken jaw or not, I seem to have one hell of a good time.
Well, that's sensational. Now, Brian, of course, as we've said, you won two Stanley Cups, the second championship in Dallas, and you shared that with former 86 Montreal teammates Guy Carbonneau and Craig Ludwig. Now, after winning a Habs Cup, of course, in 93, former Moose Jaw Warriors captain Mike Keane also joined you as well as a champion in Dallas. So I thought that was very interesting. So how much did it help the Stars in 99 having four players who had won the Stanley Cup before that in Montreal?
Well, I can even add to that list because our general manager was Bob Gainey and our coach was Doug Jarvis. So two more Habs on the list. You know, it's infectious. Winning is a very infectious thing. And when you win, you can't wait to win again. I thought there's no way I could leave this career with one loss and or one win and three losses, which is what I entered it at that point in time in 99. You know, it really is. Winning is an infectious thing. It's a thing you have to believe in, a thing you have to believe in, not only yourself, but all of your teammates. 99 was probably the only year out of my 17-year professional career that I could say we are going to win the Stanley Cup. We were that good that year. We were that deep that year. We were well-coached, well-managed. Ownership was in fantastic shape. There wasn't a thing. There wasn't a thing that was going to derail that group, and thank God it didn't. Because in 87, 88, arriving with that team, we lost Mike Modano early in the playoffs. 87, 88, we lost Joe Neuwendijk for a while. Those are two really big places or pieces to try and replace. We did have the team to sort of replace those things, but only made it to the conference final. So having those guys in full health, 99 was just one heck of a hockey year.
Right. Probably you meant 97, 98. Now, one more question before one more question, though, before we go to a break, and then we want to continue to talk to Derek and I, if you could there, Brian. But you were a great leader yourself. Maybe we'll touch on the first captain of all time in Florida. But what made Guy Carbonneau such a great leader? Because he helped lead you in Montreal to a cup, and he did it again in Dallas.
Well, to be honest with you, I think we were just trying to follow in Bob's footsteps. He was both of our captains when we both started in Montreal. A wonderful leader, as were so many, whether they had a letter or not from Larry Robinson, an assistant captain, Chris Nyland, just an everyday player that worked his ass off every day to become a better player. As a matter of fact, Knuckles grabbed all us young guys, which I said there were seven of us, took us into the video room that year, our rookie year, more or less threatened us with our lives and told us the way it's got to be every single day. Well, we adhered to that as Knuckles was a man of his word. So we really, to a man, we had a lot of fun that year. Those guys allowed us to be a little bit goofy, yet at the same time, they knew that we were learning the ropes and we cared. And we had 7-8 guys that had won the Calder Cup the year before, had that taste of winning. We definitely wanted a taste of the Stanley Cup. And it didn't hurt having the 168-pound goaltender by the name of Patrick Roy at the time. So that worked out pretty good for us.
Brian, hold on there. Don't forget, Sports Cage is brought to you by Sherwood Co-op. From locally grown fresh produce, condiments, and Western Canadian beef, your barbecue tastes better when you shop at Sherwood Co-op food stores. Sports Cage continues in just a moment.
The all-new Sports Cage is brought to you by Sherwood Co-op. From locally grown fresh produce, condiments, and Western Canadian beef, your barbecue tastes better when you shop at Sherwood Co-op food stores. Sports Cage. Text 306-936-6262. 620 CKRM.
And Don Hewitt back with Sports Cage. Let's go up to Derek Bidwell in Saskatoon.
Hey, Screwy. Brian Screwland, of course, joining us here here on Sports Cage. Now, we're, of course, now into the Stanley Cup playoffs. You won two cups. Before we get into your predictions of who may be there in the end, maybe just talk a little bit about, you hear this all the time, that it's the hardest trophy to win, and it's such a marathon and not a sprint. And maybe just talk about, I don't know, those special tangibles or that a player has to have and that a group has to have to make it all the way through and win that Stanley Cup and be able to hoist it over your head. Like you mentioned in your first Stanley Cup, in Game 5, I believe you said, that you had a broken jaw. I mean, the injuries and things that you have to play through and persevere through to be there in the end. I assume when the team wins the Stanley Cup, it's about a great team with a lot of talent, but a lot of tough guys, too, that maybe swallowed their pride, played the role they had to play, and played through a lot of injuries. Am I correct?
You are 100% correct. As a matter of fact, I'm going to start with, the most important position in Stanley Cup playoffs, and that's your goaltender. A lot of people even gave good old Saskatoonian Darcy Kemper a little bit of a hard time, saying anybody could have played net for Colorado a couple of years back. But, you know, in reality, Darcy stood on his head for a few games, played lights out from what I could tell. And so, once again, I think I'm not speaking a bunch of BS here. This is really, truly about a goaltender. And when you've got a good, healthy goaltender, maybe even two of them that time of the year, I think your opportunity, your chances of winning are even greater. Obviously, health would be number two on my list. You've got to stay healthy. I did mention losing Modano and Neuendijk different parts of their different seasons while in Dallas. That really hurt that hockey team. And then it's the idea of just everybody, you know, pulling on the rope the same way. That's when the true team stands out. You've been together working your ass off since September. The real fruition of it is that raising that Stanley Cup at the end. Let's face it, probably even more today. These guys are being paid so well today that I don't know if the compensation come playoff time is even close to what maybe a month's salary might be for some of these guys. So you know, the idea of winning that cup, there's only one every year. Go to a lot of alumni functions, and if there's one thing that I think guys really kicked themselves in the pants or missed that opportunity of winning that Stanley Cup, it's something that eats you for the rest of your life. And getting the opportunity to play in the National Hockey League is one thing. I think winning the Stanley Cup is what each and everybody laced those skates up their entire life to have that opportunity to win. So I consider myself very fortunate. At the same time, like I said, I didn't win a lot as a kid, but I'll take every Stanley Cup that I had an opportunity of winning. I'll tell you that.
Okay, Struy, now I got to know you a little bit in Calgary as well, too, when you were there as a player, and I got to know you a little bit when you were there as a coach and and did some fun, entertaining segments in my television career there with you when you were a member of the coaching. I remember one where it was about winning face-offs, and you said, and I got in trouble for that. Not in trouble for this, but there was somebody that called in and complained, because you said, okay, kids, now for face-offs, if you're not cheating, you're not trying to win. And then you talked about how to position yourselves there so you could get, it's an advantage over your opponent. I knew what you meant, but somebody would
exactly.
Was a little, yeah, I know what I knew what you meant. Yeah, but anyway, Eric, I was gonna,
you and I both got a lot of trouble from a lot of mothers during that statement. I remember that.
It was actually quite comical. I liked it. There's a lot of people that really liked it as well too, because I knew what you meant when you're talking about getting an advantage over your opponent. Try to get the most you can. Anyway, I wanted to ask you about leaders as well too. Now, we of course knew, and you worked with a great leader there in Calgary, lots of leaders throughout your hockey career in Calgary. Of course, there was Jerome Ginla. That was around the era that I was there, and the Flames of course went all the way to the Stanley Cup final before losing to Tampa Bay in 2004. But you had a lot of great leaders, and you need a lot of great leaders on a team in order to win the Stanley Cup. Now, you had a chance to wear the C, first captain in Florida Panthers history. Now, I grew up with a young Rhett Warner here in Saskatoon, and I got to know you a little bit as a member of the Florida Panthers. Well, I knew of you. You didn't know of me. I was there supporting Rhett. But what was that like, that young group? You got young Rhett Warner. You got young Ed Jovanovski. You got a lot of young players. You're a veteran there. I remember, in fact, when Rhett got drafted by the Florida Panthers, I believe when his dad, Doug W., found out that he was going to Miami, he was like, well, you're not living on your own. You're too young, and I know your personality. You're not living on your own. You're going to billet with the Stick Boys' parents is what you're going to do, and you're going to have to listen to a lot of these veterans, and they're going to teach you how to be a pro. What was that like, being a leader, wearing the C, working with all these young guys that turned out to be great hockey players? And you guys had great success there, too, in Florida.
Well, you know, right off the bat, there are two guys, you mentioned Jovanovski and Warner. There's two guys that didn't need a babysitter, didn't need their mom and dad to take care of them. They were there to win. And as much as we had a ton of fun, very mature young men that came to win. And I think that was the thing that really got me right off the bat. Not only that Rhett was from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, however, he was just a real winner and a real competitive guy. Both of them practiced like they played, which was right up my alley, right off the hop. I said, these guys are going to be huge contributors to our success. There they go to the Stanley Cup Finals their rookie year. Eddie Jovanovski, anybody that loves physicality, they can look back on Rhett and Eddie and what they ended up doing to the Big E in 1996. That entire playoff, those two young guys drove him absolutely nuts. Eddie being a bigger player, Rhett just being a tough kid. But they really contributed game in, game out, every day practice. I guess, you know, some of the things that I was able to take from my Montreal roots, take them in down to Florida with me. Some guys had never even heard. You know, the one thing that we all had in common to start with down there was that we all hated each other. It was 20 scrappy guys that were from 20 different teams, 20 different personalities, yet we found a way. I give a lot of credit to Roger Nielsen for putting that group together. He let us captains sort of run with the show, lead the young guys, lead by example, have a little bit of fun when it was permitted. Yet at the same time, we came and competed really hard day in and day out. So I wasn't surprised that we made it as far as we was, as we did. I was very excited over the fact that we had gone through three really good hockey teams. Now facing Colorado, I was more disappointed in the NHL for bringing in dehumidifiers into Florida, because playing on our ice is like playing in a dark rum and coke, a double rum and coke with lots of ice, because the ice was terrible. Yet they bring in those dehumidifiers for Sakic and Forsberg, and they could be Sakic and Forsberg, as where if we had them on the dark rum and coke ice, we thought we had a chance. But once the ice straightened out, we were sort of hooped. Pretty good hockey players. I'm sure Mario Lemieux would be disappointed to have heard that they brought in the dehumidifiers after our series, but anyway, it was very competitive hockey team, a fun team. You couldn't, I mean, for a couple of guys from Saskatchewan, you couldn't have asked for a better place to be midstream of your career. Like you said, Derek, we were down in Miami. It was a quick drive over to South Beach after the game. You knew there was always a restaurant that was open, and it was just a lot of fun for the guys. We challenged ourselves. The golfers, we found out who they were early in the season, as they weren't worth a shit after after playing 18 holes in 30-degree weather. So we did, but, you know, we policed ourselves, and that was another thing that Roger allowed us to do, sort of police ourselves. Hey, if this guy's going to be playing golf every Tuesday and we're playing on Wednesdays, you guys know he's no good, so you better have a chat with him. Well, that was the Ray Shepherds and Scotty Mellenby and some of the guys, Johnny Van Biesburg, who were good golfers on our team. But right away, those guys even understood. They grasped it, and they knew what they were there for. So lots of time in your life after you've done your career to work on your handicap.
Yes, indeed. That was a magic time. Of course, that's when all the rats were being thrown on the ice and stuff during that run with the Florida Panthers. Yeah, as I mentioned, those young guys, Ed Jovanovski and Rhett Warner, I mean, they picked a real good place to land. Well, they didn't pick it. They were drafted. I mean, they were lucky enough to land in a real good place there. And I know you're a great leader with them. They speak about you very highly all the time. And I know that their parents do. At least I can speak for Rhett's, of course, with Doug and Luann. Loved you having the C there with Rhett's pro first pro hockey team. All right, we're talking about the playoffs, of course, and all the playoffs going on. So we have to ask you your predictions. And before we let you go, Brian, I also want to talk to you about, or we're going to talk to you about, an award you just got here from the Saskatoon Minor Hockey Association. We'll get to that before we let you go. But we're talking about the playoffs, and we talked about what it takes to make it all the way to the end, all the things that have to fall in place, the leaders you got to have, the great goaltending you got to have. I mentioned the Calgary Flames back from the 0-4 run. Without Mika Kiprusoff, there's no chance. You know, they go that far probably with that team and ranked or is seeded as low as they were. Mika Kiprusoff was just brilliant for them. So now we know all the things that have to fall into place for somebody to win a Stanley Cup. You've won two of them. Who do you like? Let's start off with, who do you like coming out of the East? Who do you like coming out of the West, maybe? And who do you like in the end?
Well, I look at the Carolina Hurricanes, and I think they've been biting at the door here for a bit. So I've picked them as my representatives coming out of the East. Don't tell my friends in Florida that, please. And, you know, primarily my reason for that is those four defensemen. You've got Slavin, you've got Burns, you've got Pesci, you've got Brady Shea. The other two are great defensemen as well, and they will get their ice time. There's no doubt about that. But when you're playing against four top defensemen like that, I think it's really tough, and it seems like Andy's, you know, Anderson's in fine form here as well moving forward. So I think that's going to be a really tough out. Have always appreciated and admired their coach as well while he was playing days and where he has been since retiring. So I think Roddy's a really good coach. Out west, I'm going to go with Adam Lowry and the Winnipeg Jets. I think they're due. I would love to see Rick Bowness at his age and still coaching hoist that Lord Stanley Cup. And for the people of Winnipeg, Manitoba, I don't think there would be a sweeter thing to celebrate the spring and summer with. So those are my two official picks. After watching the Oilers and Zach Hyman last night, I'm not quite sure if I picked the right team from the West. But anyway, those are my predictions.
If you could just hang on for a second again there, Brian, we'd like to keep the chat going. Sports Cage continues in just a moment.
The all-new Sports Cage. Be part of the show. Call 936-6262 or toll free 1-866-767-0620. 620 CKRM. The all-new Sports Cage NASCAR report, Rubbin' Is Racin', is brought to you by Croft Electric. Keep the lights on in any weather with a Generac standby generator from Croft Electric. Financing available. CroftElectric.com.
And Don Hewitt, along with Derek Bidwell, back with the Sports Cage atop the driver leaderboard. Kyle Larson, driving a Chev, is dominating with 531 laps led. That's 163 ahead of Martin Truex Jr., who drives a Toyota. Larson racing for Hendrick Motorsports, and Truex for Joe Gibbs Racing. You know who Joe Gibbs is. Three Super Bowls coaching Washington, but he's now actually more famous for NASCAR. He's 83 years old and still going strong. Last Sunday, Tyler Reddick won the Geico 500 at Talladega. This Sunday, the Worth 400 will be raced at the Dover Motor Speedway in Dover, Delaware. What a historic racetrack. Dover has hosted at least one NASCAR race since 1969. Let's go up to Derek in Saskatoon.
Thanks, Don. Okay, back with Brian Strudlin, of course, two-time Stanley Cup champion. Brian Strudlin won with the Montreal Canadiens and the Dallas Stars. We were talking about him being the first captain in Florida Panthers history. Another little note about you, Brian, that I didn't know until I looked it up, is that you hold the NHL record for the fastest goal in a playoff overtime when you score the winning goal with just nine seconds into overtime. That was in Game 2 of the 1986 Finals. Before we move on, can I get you just to look back and talk about that one?
Well, let me start with the fact our line had 14 goals at the time. Claude Lemieux had 9. Mike McPhee had 5.
Okay.
Let's
do the math.
So I like how many. There's three guys here. We all have to wait to see if that adds up, right?
their centerman wasn't very productive at the time, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a few assists under my belt, but I was still waiting for that goal. So I do not know to this day what prompted our head coach Jean Perron to start the Strudlin line in overtime. But I sure as heck am glad that he did. 9 seconds later, I had my first goal. I've had neighbors walk by my house while I've been raking in the spring since I moved to Calgary post-career. And a few of them stop by and say, "Have you got a brother named Barry?" I say, "I do." And they go, "Have you ever asked him if he saw you score that overtime goal in 86? I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I hadn't." "Why do you ask?" He says, "Well, he was sitting in behind me, and we both got up to get beer after the third period, and we had our beers. He was still in the line behind us. We got held up at the checkpoint there because they were just dropping the puck, and we saw you right in front of us scoring the goal, so there was no way your brother did." My brother told I told my brother as soon as the neighbors were gone, he told me that those neighbors are smoking too much crack.
And
he said he never left his seat after the third period. So anyway, who am I going to believe? However, what a thrill. And I'll tell you guys, to this day, it's still, it takes me 100 times longer to explain the 9-second goal than it did to score it. So a lot of fun, a lot of memories, and it was J.P. Parise's record who I'd broken. The previous record was 11 seconds. And in 2011, I asked my beautiful wife to come sit with me, watch the Vancouver-Boston overtime. I said, "I just have a feeling, honey, something's going to change." Well, if Alex Burrows didn't wrap that puck around and he had shot it and scored prior to scoring at 10 seconds, I think he probably would have scored at 7 or 8 at the very max. So anyway, nice to always have that in my back pocket. I mean, I was so happy for our team, first and foremost, that we now tied the series. We never looked back, won the next three, went on to win the Stanley Cup. But another version of that was after the game. I was interviewed by CBC, and they had said, "Is that your father?" And I said, "Yeah." They said, "Well, bring him in the room with you." So Dad came in the room with me. We were sitting there doing the interview, and they must have panned out for a second to get Dad and I in. And I just remember looking at my dad and saying, you know, well, the question was sort of similar about, you know, what kind of support did you get? And I leaned over to give Dad a big cheek on there, a big kiss on the side of the cheek. Well, lo and behold, my dad turns towards me right at the time, so him and I kissed right on the lips in front of I don't know how many million viewers back then. But that wouldn't be something my dad would do on the sunniest of days. So that was one that I tried to get the tape of. Nobody to this day still can find that damn tape. So I sure hope they can, because that's something I'd love to go over with my dad before we both leave this great earth.
Yeah, that would be a good one. I know where you're coming from. Those guys are cut from a different cloth from that era. I know what you mean, Screwy, because, it's tough enough for me to give my dad a hug, you know, I couldn't imagine if it turned into something like that where our heads twisted at the same time. Brian Skirlin, one of my favorite people to talk to. We don't have that much time left, Brian, so I'm going to ask you some quicker questions here. You know, when this started, I talked with Brad Meyer, who is, of course, a well-known referee official in the Saskatoon, Saskatchewan area, and in Calgary as well, too, in the NHL, a longtime NHL referee. He has now since retired. I was talking to him about being on our show as well later this week, but I said I got Brian Skirlin on. I'm going to have Screwy on today, and I think it's going to be about an hour or so. And he said, "Bids, the only guy that I know that likes to talk more than you is Brian Skirlin. So you're going to need that full hour." And it's so great to talk to you, Brian, because you got such great stories and great insight and lots of things to say that now, of course, we're up against it here at the top of the hour. So I better move on to some other topics. First off, want to talk to you about your former junior team, the Saskatoon Blades. They're in a series now in the third round against the Moose Jaw Warriors. The Saskatoon Blades, of course, had a great regular season, having the best regular season of any team in the Western Hockey League, winning the Scotty Munro Memorial Trophy. Now, your thoughts on the Blades as they look for, well, to hopefully, finally, in the end, raise a Memorial Cup, or get a Memorial Cup title?
Well, you know, coming from Saskatoon, I felt pretty honored, simply because I was a hometown boy. Had that chance to be able to, I mean, that hometown girl that I fell in love with back when I was 13, we're going to celebrate 39 years together this summer, So the idea of having a gal in your back pocket will ruin your career? Bullshit to that. she's been my stablemate from day one, and I certainly wouldn't be here without her. So three kids, three grandkids later, we're still in love like it was our first day. So, but, you know, Saskatoon, that's the one thing. If I was disappointed in my hockey career, that was the one thing, because we were number one. Lethbridge probably number two in Canada all season long, my final year in the Western Hockey League. I happened to room with one of the guys who ruined my whole junior career by the name of Richie Sutter. And if it wasn't for Richie and Ron and a goaltender, and I'm drawing a blank right now, Kenny Reagan. I mean, we outshot those guys. If you can go back into the old record books, I bet you we outshot them 60-17, 62-14, and lost every one of our games by a goal, 2-1, 3-2. Anyway, that was a really disappointing time in my life. I just, you know, and I'd never won anything like I'd said to you before. We were number one in Canada. The expectations were so big. I really felt like I let our hometown down. So a couple years later, it was sure nice to take back a Stanley Cup and be able to share that with a lot of friends, a lot of family, and a lot of different businesses in Saskatoon that were so supportive to me back in my junior career.
Just a couple minutes left here, Screwy, so I want to ask you just a couple questions. And the next one I'm going to bring up is an honor that you received here from the Saskatoon Minor Hockey Association, SMHA, and that was an award here this past weekend. I wasn't unable to be there, actually. I brought my brother-in-law and, you know, fellow Saskatoon Blade alumni, Kevin Kaminsky. We went the next day, though, on Sunday, to the brunch to honor all these minor hockey league teams that had such a great year. But maybe just talk about getting an award from them. I'm sure you've had lots of awards over your career, but as you mentioned, you hold a special heart or place in your heart for Saskatoon, as I do. And to get another award from them, looking back on your career, any of those has to be real nice and make you feel real good.
Really a special evening. You know, no bars held. Saskatoon did such a... Kelly Bowes and his crew, Wilf Martin, that whole group just did such a fabulous job. And honoring people within the organization, Shirley, that's been there for 100 years doing all of the scheduling. If you could imagine that job way back when we didn't have computers. And I mean, just the tireless effort and work by volunteers in Saskatoon always blows me away. So a really special place. My mom and dad were able to be there. My sister and her husband, Lloyd, came up from Regina. So we had a wonderful evening, a wonderful weekend. And I just have to say thanks to Saskatoon for that. You know, it's kind of funny. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary, the Saskatoon Minor Hockey Association. I started playing when I was 10 years of age in Saskatoon. I'm 60 now. So I guess I was there for every day of Saskatoon Minor Hockey Association, the way I figure it. So anyway, I was just really humbled, honored, and you know, when I go through that list of people who have been through that great city, that great minor hockey organization, I feel blessed that that my name was drawn from the hat. So thanks to all those people in Saskatoon. And while I'm at it, Don, congratulations on your career. That's a long career to be doing one thing and doing it as well as you have.
Yes, congratulations for me too, Derek. You're telling me about your career. Boy, you've had a great one. Vancouver, Calgary, Saskatoon, all over Western Canada. I agree with Brian Skirtland.
Well, I think Brian's more talking about your longevity than mine. But yes, I agree with Screwy.
I am.
And you've had an amazing, amazing run, amazing career, of course. Don, and I've said that to you before too. Thanks, Screwy, so much for being on the show, man. I really appreciate it. And as I said, it goes by so fast this hour. And you know what? I don't think we got to everything. So if you're up for it, maybe when we get closer to the Stanley Cup final, we'll talk to a guy, of course, that's a 1-2, maybe as we get a little closer and have you on again. But thanks so much, Brian, for spending this hour with us here.
Super, guys. Thanks. And I wish you a great summer.
And Derek said, I want Brian Skirtland for an entire hour. I said, oh, really? That long? And Brian Skirtland delivered. So did you, Derek.
You did.
Anyways, thanks a lot, Brian. Sports Cage continues in a moment.
If it's happening in sports in Saskatchewan, we've got it covered. The all-new Sports Cage. Be part of the show. Call 936-6262 or toll free 1-866-767-0620. On your radio at 620 CKRM and online at sportscage.com.
And we're back with Sports Cage. Don Hewitt in Regina, Derek Bidwell in Saskatoon. Text or call us on the Capital Ford Lincoln text line 306-936-6262. Or toll free 1-866-767-0620. Capital Ford Lincoln, Saskatchewan's number one Ford retailer, CapitalFordLincoln.com. Well, we had a great guest in the first hour. Of course, two-time Stanley Cup champion, Brian Skirtland. And Derek, we've got a few texts from a few listeners and viewers who really enjoyed his interview. Brad comments, I respectfully disagree that the Stanley Cup is the toughest trophy in sports to win. I think the Memorial Cup is far tougher because you generally have a far larger turnover of players and are not able to build a team through free agency. I would sort of agree with Brad, would you, Derek?
Mm-hmm. Oh, very good point, yeah. I guess I was talking about the big four, or the ones that a lot of people you know, talk about as far as professional sports goes. Yeah, but you throw that in there, right?
Right.
I mean, right, there's the road that you have to go on to win the Memorial Cup is such a long one. And
absolutely,
you know, right there, if not there, as the toughest trophy to win, if you're going to incorporate amateur athletics in there as well, as he mentioned. I mean, talk about the Saskatoon Blades, as Brian Skirtland said. You know, the Saskatoon Blades have been around for a long, long, long time, have had great teams with some great players like Brian Skirtland and that group that he was with, and the Blades still don't have a Memorial Cup title hanging from the Raptors in Saskatoon. So, yes, very, very good point for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I believe, 62 teams in the CHL, 32 in the NHL. Mm-hmm. Oh, I got to beat 30 more teams to win the Memorial Cup. Now, Tommy and Davidson, he absolutely loved Brian Skirtland. He said, bullshit to that. LOL, what a beauty.
Yeah, well, Brian tells it like it is, and he's a great guy. Like I said, we had that fun interaction. I was working at that time for City TV in Calgary, and the deal was is that there was some type of contract set up where I would go down and learn or get tips from the Calgary Flames coaching staff on a different element to hockey every week, and we would shoot that little segment, and then we would post it. And this one was on how to win face-off draws. And Brian Skrudlin, the assistant coach of the Calgary Flames at the time, was going to do that. So I can't remember what player was there. It was probably just one of the younger guys or even somebody from the AHL that was coming up and down with the Flames. But Brian Skrudlin did all the talking, as he did in that segment mostly. He's such a great talker, such an interesting guy to listen to. And anyway, Screwy, as they call him, you know, he did the segment, and he put in there, and kids, and he took the time to point it out, and he said, kids, if you're not cheating, you're not trying to win. And right there, you know, it was a little bit of a fun bit, because we got some people calling in about that as well too. But I knew what he meant. As I said before, he was just trying to say, get every advantage over your opponent that you can. But Brian Skrudlin tells it like it is. He is, as they say in hockey circles, he is a true beauty for sure.
The all-new Sports Cage and Coast to Coast with Arash Madani is brought to you by Smart Investing Solutions. Be smart with your money. Call Brian Golly at Smart Investing Solutions, 546-2533.
And Arash Madani joins Derek Bidwell and myself on Sports Cage. Great to have you back as usual, Arash. I want to start with, you know, something that's really come up with a lot of attention in the last 24 hours, no cap again in the NHL playoffs. So the reason that the no cap rule exists, at least that's what it was reasoned when it became, you know, the way it was and the way it is because players are not paid in the playoffs. They make all of their money in the regular season. Now, amazingly, Mark Stone of Vegas recovers from a February 20th lacerated spleen. He recovers exactly on the day last night that the Golden Knights play their first playoff game in Dallas. It's got to be a sheer coincidence, I guess. Stone had the same luck, the exact same luck a year ago, coming off a long-term injury that healed exactly in time for game one of the 2023 playoffs. It's a marvel of medical science. Now, according to Cap Friendly, now, Mark Stone has a cap hit of $9.5 million. I think he makes 11, but the cap hit is $9.5 million. So Vegas, again, will have a team on the playoff ice with a larger payroll than its rival Dallas in the first round of the playoffs, Arash, and it's completely legal.
Well, the good news, Don, is that the salary cap is in place to make sure that smaller market teams and lower revenue teams can keep up with the bigger ones, so that you won't have, you know, franchises like Arizona relocate to Salt Lake City. Well, no, that didn't work either, did it? Yeah, right. So,
yeah,
it's I'm always perplexed. What is the point of a salary cap? It is to control costs. And yet the moment you institute it, no matter what the league, all everybody looks to do is find ways to circumvent it.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the NBA, you have teams that are in the luxury tax. In the NFL, the cap is one thing. Your salary cap is one thing. But the cash spent is altogether different. When the Rams beat the Bengals in the Super Bowl, whatever that was, 2 or 3 years ago, the Rams' player payroll of cash that year was like $60 million more than Cincinnati's.
Mm-hmm.
So, optically, I guess I understand why there's a cap. You know, you fully understand why there's a floor. But then, from a competitive balance standpoint, there's no fairness there at all. And what it's set out to do, like the Coyote situation, it doesn't do that one either.
I know. Now, is Vegas general manager Kelly McCrimmon, who we knew so well from Brandon in these parts, is he flaunting this no cap rule, or is it possible, Arash, that you can flaunt anything when you're not breaking a rule.
Well, I'm old enough to remember what you and Derek were talking about before you had me on. What was Brian Scrutland's line? If you're not cheating, you're not trying.
Yeah.
That's right.
Look, the moment you institute anything, any kind of rule, any kind of stipulation, everybody's looking for ways to get around it. And when parameters are put in place on anything, be it an on-ice, on-field rule, be it an off-ice, off-field, off-court, you know, thing in the collective bargaining agreement, you're going to have GMs and coaches and executives and people just saying, okay, well, how can we work around this? And my issue always, like in the new NFL kickoff rule, what are the unintended consequences of what we're doing? What are the unintended consequences of the cap? What are the unintended consequences if you're on injured reserve that it's not going to be a cap hit? These aren't really talked about at the competition committee level. And then what ends up happening is this, and then there's egg on everybody's face.
Yeah.
So I just find with pro sports, regardless of the league, it's such a reactive instead of a proactive league and proactive situation, because we all know this isn't right. We all know that Vegas isn't abiding by the quote-unquote spirit of it, but who cares if it helps you win? You know, there's no asterisk on the Stanley Cup that,
right.
You know, Mark Stone's spleen recovery lasted longer, you know?
The old spleen asterisk on the Stanley Cup, yeah.
I don't know
if they're going to put that one on there, but that would be very interesting, though, Arash. Yeah, and let me go off on a little bit of a tangent here. We're talking about, you know, the Big Four, and we talked about, you know, salaries and all that. Well, one that really bugs me, Arash, is Major League Baseball, because that, of course, is a different one. That's not a salary cap. That's a salary tax. So as a fan, I would be like, how are we ever going to win? If I'm a Pittsburgh Pirates fan or somebody like that, how are we ever going to win if teams can spend over the limit and then they just get fined, but the New York Mets and the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox and the Philadelphia Phillies and the Texas Rangers and the Houston Astros, it doesn't matter to them because that's just more money. So they just say, well, it costs us that much more money. We have to pay a tax penalty at the end of the year. But look at all the money we made when more people come into the games, and look how far we went to the World Series, and look at how our product and our has gone up. So they're going to make it back anyway. But Pittsburgh Pirates and teams like that, or the old Montreal Expos, they could never do that. So as a Major League Baseball fan,
well,
and I know you're...
Whoa. They absolutely can do that, Derek. Their ownership chooses not to do that. Now, these are two totally different things.
So you're saying the Pittsburgh Pirates could spend as much money as the New York Yankees?
I am telling you that the Pittsburgh Pirates' profit this year will be more than the Texas Rangers' profit this year, even with the Rangers spending whatever they're spending. But there's a couple of things here at play, and just hear me out, and I want to make this kind of as user-friendly as possible. Let's just go back 4 years. COVID hits, no one's allowed in the stadiums, right? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Let's remember all of these leagues of the Big Four, they all played in front of nobody. And they didn't do that out of the goodness of their heart. Their business model is set up between television revenue, national, local, and, you know, merchandising and all those kinds of things, that they are in a cash flow positive situation before they sell a ticket and a hot dog and a Coke and a beer and a parking spot. So what in baseball, you are given the parameters to spend whatever you want. There's also no guarantee that if you're the highest spending team, you're going to win. Let's remember that too.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately this comes down to, what does your owner want to spend? And it's not that they can't. They absolutely can. These franchises sell for $2 billion with a B. It's what's the appetite. So the owner of the Pittsburgh Pirates looks around and says, wait a minute here. I can spend as little as I want, but I'm still going to get the, you know, very close to the same revenue as a middle market team, and I can spend $60, $70 million less on player payroll, all right, let's do that. And then if these prospects hit, maybe I'll spend free agency and maybe I won't. I'm not saying that's the right thing to do, but I just think it's really important. All these people, you know, owners want to be called Mr. Well, Mr. Smith, get off your wallet and write the damn check. If you expect me to come and shell out $150 for a ticket and $18 for a large can of beer and $9.50 for a fountain Coke and $8 for a bottle of water.
Gotcha. Crazy. Yeah. So, yeah, so what you're saying is, of course, it's up to the owners. Like we heard about the New York, what the New York Mets spent last year was just crazy. And we knew that their owner was.
And where'd that get them?
Oh, yeah. Didn't get him a championship, of course, as we all know. So he just decided to spend like crazy. And then these other teams, all right, like the Pittsburgh Pirates. It's got to be disheartening for those fans. And you buzz around all over Major League Baseball, and you're all over the place in these stadiums. It's got to be disheartening, though, for these fans of these other markets when they know that at the start of the year, before anything happens in 162 games, that the chances of them being there at the end are probably fairly thin. And even if they are able to be there in the end, what are the chances that their owner, if he's the one that could spend more, you know, is going to keep that team around?
Well, it all depends. You know, nobody had the Arizona Diamondbacks on their bingo card at the start of last season, and they went all the way to the World Series out of nowhere. They barely got into the playoffs to begin with. Wouldn't have gotten in if it wasn't for the expanded playoffs. And then, God bless them, they actually ended up spending on some free agents this offseason and are going for it. But for the majority, like, we can look at the teams in baseball right now, the 30 teams in baseball, and we can really, without even trying, eliminate 15 of them, and we'd probably be right on 14. And it's still April. I'm with you, Derek. Like, that's the reality of the situation. But look, I was told a long time ago by a football coach who was really, I was just breaking into pro sports. And he said, kid, let me give you a little piece of advice. He said, good ownership wins. Good leadership wins. And if you look around pro sports, good ownership and good leadership is what wins. Because good ownership means you're going to have good people at the helm. It's going to be a good structure. They know what they're, you know, you're going to draft well. You're going to hire well. You're going to be patient. You're not going to make knee-jerk reactions. You're not going to shoot off from the hip. All those kinds of things.
Make good decisions as well, too, for the, yeah, and make good decisions as well, too, Arash, for the people at the top of the chain, right?
Yeah. And it's like any organization. It doesn't matter what you do for a living. For the people listening right now, coming, you know, driving home from work, think about where you work. What are among the more important things? It's the people who are making those decisions, the people in the leadership positions, the people who have the big executive jobs, the decisions they make day in and day out, how they manage the people that are working for them, how they lead. All of that matters in your day-to-day job. Well, pro sports is a business, too. And so the only, you know, the difference is the employees are coaches and support staff and trainers and equipment people and nutritionists and players. And so that's how that all kind of comes to be.
Coast to Coast with Arash Madani, brought to you by Smart Investing Solutions. Be smart with your money. Call Brian Gawley at Smart Investing Solutions. 546-2533. There's obviously, Arash, not a more polarizing team in Canada than the Maple Leafs. You like them, I hate them.
I don't like them. I'm no Leaf fan.
Oh, good. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, if you're a sports fan, you're right. You love them or hate them. I don't know. Are you a Leaf fan, Derek, or no?
You know what? I don't have a particular team that I just attach my wagon to, but I did like the Maple Leafs when Wendell Clark was on the Maple Leafs. Because
right.
being from Saskatoon, I grew up,
absolutely.
I idolized yep. Wendell Clark. Whatever team Wendell Clark played on, that's what team I rooted for. Now that Wendell Clark is not in the league, hasn't been in for a long time, I just kind of, I just jump on bandwagons, I think is what I do, yes. When I was in Calgary, I rooted for the Flames, but now right. I'm just looking for a bandwagon to jump on it.
Well, like them or not, Arash, last night in Boston, they left a message and they sent a statement to the Bruins.
Yeah, and I think they also sent a statement to their own fan base, right? Because the Maple Leafs that I've been watching since moving to Toronto in 2009, down a game, in the playoffs, on the road to the Bruins, they give up a goal in the last, 30 seconds of that first period to go down 2-1, and you're saying to yourself, this thing's a wrap. They're about to lose by 4 or 5 goals.
Here we go.
Yep.
And they had some resolve to them. They, they had a goal waved off on the high stick by Bertuzzi. You're saying to yourself, this is where it collapses. Nope, they answered right back with a goal. When push came to shove and the game's hanging in the balance, their best player was their best player. And Austin Matthews delivered. Like, I looked at that game last night in a lot of ways. Sheldon Keefe's future is on the line here. Brendan Shanahan's might be. This is a massive playoff series for the future of the franchise. That may have been one of the biggest. This is how pathetic the Leafs have been for the last 25 years. That may have been one of the most, game two of first round, may have been one of the most important wins that they've had in the playoffs. Shoot, since the 90s.
You know what? That's a really good point, Arash, and I agree with that too, because you think about the implications that would unfold after that if, like you said, if things start to really go off the rails for the Leafs after that first period, and they come out in the second, and they get smoked. Third, they get smoked. They lose the game. Now they're down 2-0 to the Boston Bruins, and everybody goes, here we go again! And then they decide, big changes have to happen.
Yeah, the thing about this, they go down 0-2 to the Bruins again. Boston, again. And if they come home for Game 3 tomorrow night and the Bruins score first, what is that building going to be like? Instead, it's a brand new series.
It is. Arash, thanks for so much of your insight. We've got a long list of things we still want to talk to you about, but it'll have to be on another Sports Cage because the time goes by just so fast. Thanks for joining Derek and I. Sports Cage continues in just a moment.
The all-new Sports Cage is brought to you by Bronco Plumbing and Heating, where professional service is guaranteed. They'll treat you right. 781-2090. Back to the all-new Sports Cage. Text 306-936-6262. 620-CKRM.
And it's Don Hewitt, along with Derek Bidwell in Saskatoon, back with Sports Cage, a very interesting discussion we just had with Arash Madani about the Maple Leafs. And you know what? One thing about the Maple Leafs, they make the money in the playoffs for Rogers. Millions and millions of dollars are on the line for Rogers, whether or not the Leafs get by the first round. Wow, they haven't been by the second round for a long time. But you know what? I think they're going to beat the Boston Bruins. I really do. Do you think so? What do you think, Derek? I think they're going to beat Boston.
I do as well, too. And you're talking about how much money goes into this, and I don't really have a lot of reference and don't know where we are right now in the financial game with the NHL, but I can tell you that way back in 2004 when the Calgary Flames were making their Stanley Cup run, and we did a story on them at CTV in Calgary, and the Flames, through ticket sales, just through ticket sales, were making around, I want to say it was somewhere around $1 million a game. So you just add in all the home games that you get as you continue to advance, depending how far that series goes, and you go through the rounds. I mean, that's a lot of money. And that was 2004, and the Calgary Flames are not a big a market team as the Toronto Maple Leafs. So yes, big, big money at stake. I think the Leafs are going to get by the Boston Bruins after that. Who knows? They could go as far as they want.
With CHOQ CFL and Saskatchewan Rough Rider legend Glenn Suter is brought to you by Quality Tire. With 9 locations across Saskatchewan, visit qualitytire.ca.
And Glenn Suter, a broadcaster and former professional football player in the CFL, joins us on the Western Pizza Hotline. Perfect pizza with a generous amount of toppings, plus Greek food like souvlaki, ribs, salads, all the goodness. You can't make it home. Why not call Western Pizza today? And, of course, press coverage, Quality Tire, with 9 locations across Saskatchewan, qualitytire.ca. And always great to be back with press coverage with Glenn. And the first question I wanted to talk to Glenn about, and hear me out, Glenn, briefly, should the CFL pay their quarterback so much money? Now, Logan Bandy, a backup offensive lineman, just retired from Saskatchewan a few days ago from the Saskatchewan Roughriders at the age of 24. We've had some other younger players across the CFL in the last few months retire at a reasonably young age. Bandy is going to chiropractic school, so he can help a lot of other football players get over their aches and pains. Now, the CFL cap, as Glenn well knows, and so does Derek, for 2024 is $5.525 million. So if you pay a quarterback $600,000, which some of the teams are doing, you are taking up 10.859% of your total cap space on one player. If you pay your quarterback $500,000, which a few others are doing, then you're taking up 9.04% of your total cap space on just one player. So, Glenn, I know the quarterback is the most important position on a field. He's the guy that a lot of fans pay money to see perform, but is almost, in some cases, 11% of your total player cap too much?
No, you know, I think it's totally up to the team and the situation that the team is in, the quarterback and where he's at in his career, the, you know, the quarterback's resume that you're dealing with. I really believe that, you know, every team in the league, even the community-owned teams like Saskatchewan, would like to pay everybody more. They'd like to increase the cap. They want to pay the players more. They want to compensate them more. But they have to work within the restrictions of the budget and revenues and make sure that balance sheet looks right at the end of the day. And so that's, you know, I think it's easy to say, you know, players, when you're talking Players Association or whatever, to say, well, players should get paid more. It's not fair that they don't get paid. You know, well, that's easy, but not if the owners are losing money. And if they're not losing money and they're breaking even or making small amounts year to year and it's growing, then the players will get paid more, but they need to be patient. And it might not be their generation. It might be the next generation. You know, I mean, back 10 years ago, quarterbacks weren't getting $600,000. You know, so I'm okay with paying them. And I think this goes to a bigger discussion, Don, in a lot of ways, and it goes to the discussion on the cap. I heard you and Arash talk about that in the earlier segment, just to talk about the cap and the importance of the cap. And other sports ignore it, and they overspend anyway, and they don't care because, you know, it's important to have it because every market should have the same. You know, if you're a good football organization, you can win championships. So you bring in the right coaches, the right players. You're doing it for the right reasons and the right messaging and narratives. Those are the things that should lead you to winning. And I agree with Arash in leadership and ownership, so important. But again, that goes to the football acumen of these people. But if you just say, well, teams can just go ahead and buy a team, like buy all the best players or buy the top players in free agency, then, you know, I mean, it doesn't guarantee winning for sure, but it skews the expectation of fan bases. It can erode fan bases. You know, if owners could just step back sometimes and look at it from a broader perspective and say, You know, guys, if we live on this, on with a cap that we all, you know, make sure we don't break the rules. Just, you got to live with this cap and you've got to manage this cap. So you want to pay quarterback 10% of your cap? That's your call. It's going to cost you somewhere else in the roster, possibly. Now, you know, we're equating bigger salaries with better talent, and that doesn't always translate. You know, sometimes a guy has a hot year, he becomes the highest paid player in the league, and his next year, not so hot. So all of a sudden you've overpaid for a receiver or a running back or whatever. So that happens all the time too. But, you know, I've often said I would love to see a golf tournament where every player is customized for size, but has to use the same golf clubs. Same brand, same clubs, and all the entire field uses the same clubs. Let's see who wins when they're all using it. And I don't know the race car rules as well as I'm sure a lot of listeners do, but I'm sure there is one of those races where the cars have certain specs that they absolutely have to adhere to. Like, they can't add things or, you know, juice your car in a different way that is new innovation. So you have to be within these standards, sort of like a cap. Your car, all the cars are basically the same, so the drivers win. If the driver is the best driver, he wins. And he might not even be the highest paid driver. But if he's the best driver on that day, he wins. And I think these caps should be adhered to. I think that it should be punitive if you break the rules, and make it very difficult, like, make it the severity of the penalty at a point where owners will just stop doing it. And you, that's the only way you curb the behavior.
And I think the CFL is actually doing a great job of that, Glenn and Derek, because, I mean, three teams were fined just a week or so ago for going over the cap in the CFL. And I'd also say football in general does a better job than the other sports in having harder caps. I'm talking about the NFL and the CFL. So they've got a lot of good parity in the sport of football, I think, for that reason. But I'll go back, and I annoy you a little bit here, Glenn, maybe harping on this topic, but I mean, the spring leagues, most of them over the years, even though they fail, have capped quarterback salaries. So I'm often wondering, you know, unless a quarterback's in the NFL, he has nowhere else to go to make big money, like $500,000, $600,000. So why not pay him $350,000? I guess I'm just getting to the point of saying, like, so many of the players in the CFL, and I know they're not quarterbacks, but, you know, they're leaving for chiropractic school. And I don't see where any of these quarterbacks are going to go if they make $350,000 or maybe even $400,000 instead of $600,000. I would think they're still going to play, or am I wrong on that?
Well, no, you're bang on right. And, you know, I've had, when I was working with TSN in the sports center department, because early in my career I did both. I was working, obviously, with the CFL, but that's why I was hired. But I wanted to prove to TSN early in my career that I could be a reporter covering the Canucks or, you know, at the time, the Vancouver Grizzlies. So when I was doing that, I would often run into, after an assignment, I'd run into an NHL hockey player or one of the NBA guys, usually at the Roxy, if anyone knows. if anyone knows about that, well, you know what's weird? My son plays in the band there now, so that's
oh, wow.
Anyway.
Full circle.
So, but my point is that I would run into athletes that were making, you know, $4 or $5 million a year or whatever it was, and I would often ask them the same question. I would say, hey, you know, I'm in a completely different world in the CFL. I basically take a zero off of everything. Yeah. But if you were told that you could make $150,000 playing in the NHL, or you could make $300,000 playing in the NHL, would you still play? Or do you have, is it the $4 million a year that's in that year? And to a person, to an athlete, they all said the same thing. And this answers your question. Absolutely, they'd play. Of course they would play. If they could make a good living, support their families, and play hockey for a living, they'd play. So this idea that, you know, if we paid them less, would they just decide? No, they're going to play. Because you know, this is the dream that you have as a kid, and you get a chance to play professionally and make a living doing it, you're going to go after that. So, if that was the case, no, they wouldn't disappear, and they wouldn't decide to retire or anything like that. They'd still be there. But again, going back to the initial point, that owners are trying to compensate these guys as much as they possibly can because of what they sacrifice and put on the line out there to entertain the fans and to try and bring home a championship. Yes, they love it. Yes, it's their dream. They do it anyway. But they are, you know, it's a physical game. It's a physical sport. So, you know, I think the market should dictate. If you have Zach Collaros, he has earned as much as you can pay for him. But if you have three rookies in your camp at quarterback, then you're as a GM, if you're giving one of those guys 10% of your salary cap, I would call that just a bad decision.
Yeah.
It all depends on the circumstance.
I agree with you, Suits, on a whole bunch of points that you made, actually. And one of them is just that one there, is that, you know, if you're making bad decisions, well, maybe you're the team that has, you know, a little bit of a combination of everything. You guys have a great team. You have great talent. You have great leaders, but you also got great people upstairs making the right decisions. And they're navigating those waters, or they're balancing their checkbook, or they're working their way through the salary cap system the best. And so they're being rewarded. They're putting their money in the right pots instead of just dumping it all into one. And maybe if somebody dumps it all into one, all of a sudden maybe that player gets injured. Well, now you got nothing. And so there's a lot of different ways that you can almost, there's the game on the field, and then there's the game in the front office as well. And I think a lot of great organizations have to have a balance with both. The other thing too, I was going to mention about players wanting to play. I never had a chance to play high level football. I only played junior football here in Saskatchewan for the Saskatoon Hilltops. Who won a national championship. That was great. But I never had a chance, not even a sniff of a chance to play professional football. But I know a lot of guys that I played that might cut off just the tip of their pinky finger, maybe not on their right hand, maybe on their left, might cut off the tip of their pinky finger that I played on the Hilltops with, that would love to play in one CFL game. Not sit on the bench, but actually play in a CFL game, and maybe even more so if it was for their beloved Saskatchewan Roughriders. It's not just for everybody. You know, we're talking about Logan Bandy. You know, he's going to be a chiropractor. I mean, that's a pretty good decision. There's an offensive lineman that maybe not a lot of people know that used to play for the Kansas City Chiefs. He was a starter for a number of years, and I'm going to probably wreck his name, but Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. He was a starting offensive lineman for the Kansas City Chiefs. And then when COVID hit, he went back to Quebec, and he was practicing as a doctor. And then when the teams came back out of COVID, he just decided that he was going to retire. I believe that's when he did it. And he was just going to stay a doctor, stay a physician, and not go back into the NFL. So for a lot of people, it's not just the money. It's whether they are still in it 100% or they're not. But I agree with you. There's a lot of people that if the money was even at all decent, they would love to play in the Canadian Football League. They would love to play in the Canadian Football League. They would love to play for their hometown team. I think there's a lot of people out there that still think that way. A lot of young players that still think that way.
Yeah, you're right. And two things, Derek. One is, I'm looking right now in my downstairs office, and on the wall is a signed jersey of Ronnie Lott, who was a favorite player of mine growing up.
Speaking of pinkies.
And that's exactly why I bring it up, because, yeah, he did cut off his pinky to play in a playoff game. So, and I got to meet him up at the dog's breakfast, and that's why I have this all signatured up here. But the point is that you're right that, you know, guys, let's put it this way. If you're making $4,400,000 or $40,000 playing pro football, if you are playing for the money, you aren't going to last very long. And I just, you know, I know a lot of guys love to have their bling down south, and they drive fancy cars, and they buy four houses. And, you know, I watched a documentary recently of the NBA players that I don't know, some like 35% of them are bankrupt when they retire. Like, you know, they make, it doesn't matter what you make, it's what you spend. And honestly, if you are playing a sport that requires physically of you what football requires of you, then you're not going to last long if you're playing for money. You have to love it. You have to be passionate. You have to be tough as nails mentally and physically. You have to be disciplined as heck. You have to be a great teammate. All of those things have to happen for you to have any kind of career at the highest levels of football. And you know, that's where money's great and we all need it. And to make a living playing it is awesome. And you want to make as much as you can and you want to pay the guys as much as you can. But I'll tell you what, if you're in it for the money, you're not going to last long.
I agree with you, Suits. And there's a good point that former NFL coach and player Herman Edwards makes to the players. I believe he still speaks to them when they all come into the league. They have a little bit of a conference, if you will, and they have guys like Herman Edwards come in and talk to these guys about money and say, listen, you could live like a king for a few years or you could live like a prince for the rest of your life. You only need one car. You only need one house. You know, get established in the league. Slow down. Pump the brakes with the spending. And he always tries to get these guys back on track. So, yeah, you could make $400,000 or $4 million. If you're not going to be smart with your money, you're probably going to ought to have a lot left in the end. Anyway, I want to talk to you quickly, Glenn, about the University of Saskatchewan Huskies and something that is near and dear and close to your heart. We, of course, love both our teams here, our U Sports teams in the province of Saskatchewan, and we love their great rivalry, the University of Regina Rams and the U of S Huskies football team. The Dogs Breakfast is coming up next week, a great fundraiser in Saskatoon here, and I've heard you speak at it a few times, and maybe just talk a little bit about that one and the success of that and how... you know, you enjoy being a part of it and how it really brings a lot of money for scholarships to keep the football players here in Saskatchewan.
Well, I've been the MC of that. I was a guest speaker early on, and I want to say it was almost more than 15 years ago now. I think it went me and then Bobby Jurison was the next year. And the next year, because Bobby and I had a great relationship as teammates, I MC'd that year. And from that year till today, or till this coming, you know, May 1st. Yeah. The breakfast this year with Sean Payton as our guest speaker. I've been the MC every year since then. So yeah, it is a fantastic, I get more out of it than I give. I know that because the best part of the Dogs Breakfast is to watch the high school kids receive their jerseys from the coaches and a couple of the players, and they get their jerseys and their college football career, which could for some lead to a pro career that we've just talked about. It begins that day. You know, the commitment level goes up. High school, there's a big jump from high school to college, and that sort of ceremonial transfer of the, you know, you're part of us now. You're a Husky now. You're a Ram now. And this is what we stand for. This is what we are. When they walk over that stage and I see their faces, and some of them are like big, huge eyes, like deer in the headlights. Some of them are really nervous. Some of them are excited. Yeah. Some of them are pumped to show what they can do. I'm sure they're all got a little bit of everything in there, but that's part of the, that's the best part of it. And we've had some great speakers through the years. Ronnie Lott was one of them one year. And we have Sean Payton, who I think, honestly, guys, this year it'll be the best year. I've heard Sean, Coach Payton talk before, whether it be NFL films or whatever, plus that Kenny Chesney video, The Boys of Fall. He's at the beginning of that as well. But He is dynamic. He's one of those guys, if you are sitting in the locker room and he's doing the pregame speech, you're busting through that door to get on the field and kick it off. So I really think this is going to be an exciting one this coming May.
Sports Cage is brought to you by Bronco Plumbing and Heating, where professional service is guaranteed. They'll treat you right at Bronco Plumbing and Heating. 781-2090. You know, guys, every year the best halftime show at Mosaic Stadium, sort of as Glenn was alluding to, is the little tykes out there, the minor football players. Some of them are knee-high to a grasshopper. Their helmets are all seem so big on their little heads.
They're like bobbleheads, right? They just
favorite,
tip over.
Yeah, that's my favorite. Glenn, that's my favorite halftime show, to watch these little tykes playing football. It's hilarious.
Yeah, you know what, Don? I love it, too. And, in fact, it's funny you say that, because every year in the off season, we discuss as a group at TSN just different ideas. It could be a little thing. It could be a huge thought or something that we want to innovate. We want to try and bring the viewer something new. And I've been saying for the last couple of years now that I'd love to see more kids on our program somehow, like throwing to commercial. Maybe we have a 9-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid mm-hmm. playing minor football who looks into the camera and says, my favorite player is Trevor Harris of the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. And then we see a little play from this 10-year-old and we go to commercial. I don't know how we do it, but I think we need to get more kids on television playing the sport, because they look fantastic and I love it. And here's one little thing, too, that I think the league in general can correct. The most minor football teams in our country name their teams after NFL teams. They mm-hmm. don't yeah. name their teams after CFL teams. Now, there's only, you know, there's not enough CFL teams to cover all of the minor football leagues and all of the teams, but you could go into college ranks and things like that, because when a 10-year-old kid puts on a New York Giants logo helmet, guess what he does when he goes home? He goes home and Googles the New York Giants, and that team becomes his team when he's 10 years old. And when he's 19 years old and he wants to buy a ticket, he's going to fly to New York and go see the Giants rather than go to Saskatchewan and see them if, when he was 10, he had a Rider logo on his helmet.
Man, that is a tough nut to crack, with the millions and millions of dollars that the NFL spends on the flag football programs for youngsters and all wearing NFL jerseys. But let's hope things can happen in marketing, Glenn, and the CFL, that they can sort of counter some of that. That's for sure.
Yeah, flag football is a good one, Don, because it's on it. You know, it's growing so rapidly here, and it'll be in the Olympics, and then it'll just explode. So let's get ahead of that. I hope the league is working on a plan right now to put CFL logos on every flag in Canada.
Do it. Well, Glenn, time always goes by too fast when you're on the Sports Cage, but thanks for joining Derek and I once again. Sports
thanks,
Cage
Glenn.
Continues in just a moment.
Happening in sports in Saskatchewan, we've got it covered. The all-new Sports Cage. Be part of the show. Call 936-6262 or toll-free 1-866-767-0620. On your radio at 620 CKRM and online at sportscage.com.
And it's Don Hewitt back with Sports Cage, along with Derek Bidwell in Saskatoon. Sports Cage is brought to you by Busy Bee Overhead Doors. Busy Bee will repair or replace your residential or commercial garage door so you don't get stuck in or out, especially in the wintertime in Saskatchewan. Catch the Busy Bee Doors specialists and they'll get the work done. You know, Derek, we were talking earlier with Arash commenting on how polarizing the Toronto Maple Leafs are. Well, we've certainly had some anti-Maple Leaf texts, one from Eli just a few minutes ago, so sounds like Arash is correct. But terrible news, Derek, for the Vancouver Canucks. Thatcher Demko is injured, their outstanding goaltender.
Yeah, that's a tough one, because Vancouver, of course, playing so well during this regular season in Rick Tocchet's first season as their new head coach. And Thatcher Demko looks like he's going to be gone. Well, he's day-to-day. They got him listed as day-to-day right now. So if you got him in your pools and all this, and if you're a Canucks fan, maybe don't fret just yet. They have him listed as day-to-day, but it sounds like he could possibly also be gone for the rest of this first round series. If the Canucks are able to get by, it will be due to Casey DeSmith as their last line of defense. He's a 32-year-old. If people are unaware or unfamiliar with Casey DeSmith, he will be taking over for Thatcher Demko until he returns. Rick Tocchet did say, though, that it's not the same knee injury that Demko had a problem with. It's something else, and he's listed as day-to-day. But sometimes in the playoffs, whether you're talking about anything, whether you're talking about the NBA, the NFL, especially hockey, because we were so hockey-crazed here in Canada, Don, that you get these stories that come out, and you know, they're really ones that people can run with and everybody kind of get behind. Now, we hope that Thatcher Demko comes back as soon as he can, and he's as healthy as soon as he can be. But if Casey DeSmith stands on his head, gets this opportunity, stands on his head as a 32-year-old goalie now being put in the spotlight, I would love that story. I would get behind that story. I'm not, I don't root against the Canucks. I don't necessarily root for the Canucks. They're another Canadian team, so I want them to do well. But if Casey DeSmith stands on his head, gets an opportunity and stands on his head, I'll get by the Canucks because I'll get behind that story. So fingers crossed he can make the most of this opportunity. We'll wait and see.
Yeah, and they got DeSmith off the scrap heap from Montreal, who didn't even play him, so it would be quite a story. You're right about that. Well, it's April. It's late April, and for many of us, the fishing season isn't closed, but it's pretty close. That doesn't sound like it makes sense, but Jason Manatee hopefully will clear that up. For many of us in southern Saskatchewan, south of Prince Albert, that all changes on May 5th. And let's get some explanations here. We want to talk about the north as well and the Great Lakes in Saskatchewan. Jason Manatee of getfishing.ca joins us on The Cage. Welcome to The Cage, Jason, from Derek and myself. Well, when you say the season is closed, what do you mean?
Well, basically, the season for the most popular sport fish, walleyes, pike, and perch, the ones that people typically fish for, the season's closed for those. And the reason is, you know, they're a spring spawner, so this is the time where they make more fish for everybody else. And any waters in which those fish roam are closed. Now, to clear up the confusion, the Saskatchewan Angler's Guide, which every angler who buys a license needs to read and know the regulations, it shows a series of what are stock trout lakes. And those lakes, because those stock trout are what are referred to as put-and-take fisheries, meaning they stock the fish, you catch them and take them home to eat, they don't reproduce. They wouldn't have fish if they weren't stocked. So because of that, those lakes are open, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay, so you say it's open for stock trout. Why is it closed for everything else?
Well, when it comes to, you know, pike, walleye, and perch, in that order, they reproduce and make more babies for you know, the next generation. So it makes sense that on March 31st, and when you go a little farther, a little bit later in April, they close the season so that you are not able to fish for those species. So it gives those fish an opportunity to have a bit of a sanctuary to get their business done, Don, to make more fish for the next generation.
I have a question in regards to ice fishing. Of course, we're now into regular fishing or open water fishing now, and the ice has left, and ice fishing season is behind us now for another season. But was it a successful ice fishing season? And it seems to me that I'm seeing more and more of these ice fishing derbies that are really gaining a lot of momentum. I want to say there was one up at, I want to say it was Meeting Lake or Montreal Lake this past year. I'm not positive. Sorry on the location, but I had a friend that entered it, and he showed me some pictures, and they looked like there was hundreds of people out there. They raised a ton of money. Was it a great ice fishing season? And does it seem to be getting more and more popular? It sure seems to me from the outside looking in.
Well, for sure, it's absolutely getting more popular. And part of the reason is that we've got a lot more comfort than we used to have. You've got pop-up tents, you've got portable heaters, you've got underwater cameras.
Yeah.
You know, and not to mention, we had a really mild winter, which is good and bad. It was a bit bad to get the ice super thick and generally thick as it usually gets in Saskatchewan. But when it's milder out, more people want to be outside. More people will say, well, maybe I will go out ice fishing. honestly, you know, this year I don't think I set up a shelter once, maybe once, but when it was windy, just because it was so nice and mild. So absolutely, it is getting more popular, and derbies, not just in Meeting Lake or wherever you mentioned, they're all over the place, and they have prizes, and it's just a fun time out.
I have a buddy that's into this, and you mentioned the gadgets and the different things that you can get, and man, once he got into it, he really got into it. Now, there's a lot of things you can do. If you got some good bucks, you can obviously make yourself a really cool fishing shack. Now, you can just have one that's the bare bones and just the basics. You can have one where you can have a setup where you're just sitting on a couple of stools or piles of snow, I suppose, in front of a hole in the ice, and you can be successful that way too. But you can go the other way, where I got this buddy, you know, he's got the cameras, he's got the shelters, he's got the great augers that can dig the big holes, and they can dig them fast, and he can move spots. But I also know some other pals of his that are maybe a little more well off, if you will. Their fishing shacks are not the bare bones. They got TVs in there. They're all done up on the inside. It's like a man cave. Some of these fishing shacks and some of these setups that these guys have are really, really cool. In fact, I even saw, I want to say CTV did a story on a group in Saskatchewan, and they had an old fuselage of a small airplane that they had, the wings were off it, and the wheels were off it.
Ouch.
And they just dug a hole in the bottom, and they wheeled it out there. They had it as a sled, and they wheeled it out there, and they used that as their ice fishing shack. So a lot of different gadgets out there, and a lot of people doing some creative things, it seems like.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's very, you can get into this and do it for very little money, but if you have the means and the desire to, you know, convert an old plane into a shack, clearly it's been done, you can do it. And lots of times people bring their satellite TV, generators, you name it out there, watch TV on one monitor and watch an underwater camera on another monitor. So the sky's the limit of what you can do.
You know, I was getting groceries on Sunday, and this dude drives up beside me in the parking lot. He's got a brand new truck. He's hauling a beautiful brand new Lund fishing boat. And I thought, wow, that's crazy. I wonder how much money that cost. But anyway, Jason, you know, there were a number of screens in and around the dashboard and the steering wheel. It looked like a computer area, almost like an office. So what are you seeing on all of these multiple screens? Like, how far has technology gone in fishing?
Well, again, you know, budgets, you know, play a big role in how many and how big those screens are, you know, in terms of what, yeah, you, the kind of technology you have. But we have everything from the technology that maps the lake bottom for you so you can see the best fishing spots, some with different live sonar that shoots at different angles, not just the bottom, but off to the side and in a circular pattern, you name it. So basically, the more toys and the more scanners and the more maps you have, the more screens you need to be able to see them all. And again, you know, like, the bigger the screens, the better you can see. And when you got a few, you know, miles on the odometer and your eyes aren't so good, the bigger the screen, the better. So that's essentially, you know, how you rate the technology that you want. And of course, you know, it's all good, it's all fun stuff, you know, but obviously when you're getting into bigger boats, bigger screens, you're looking at bigger budgets to be able to do that. And not, you don't have to is the key, but you can do it if you want to and you got the money.
Jason, what's next on the schedule? If you're looking at the Saskatchewan fishing schedule, what's next on there? Are there some certain dates that people should be marking on their calendar and preparing for and getting all their gadgets and their boats and everything ready to go for?
Absolutely. Well, the target date for me, there's three of them that I want to mention to the provincial audience. And in the southern zone, which is basically in a line, Highway 55, Prince Albert South, the southern zone, all the way to the U.S. border. May 5th is when you can go fish. All those waters is when the season opens. So I'm going to make sure and do my best to spend May 4th making sure my boat is tip-top and filled with fuel and all my lines and rods and reels are re-spooled for that date. The central zone, which is basically PA, just a little bit past L'Orange, that central section of the province, the season opens May 15th for all those species, and then the extreme north opens on May 25th. So those are the key dates that things get real in a hurry for the angling public.
If you're a novice fisherman like myself, but you're wanting to get into it, which I would like to get into it a lot more than I currently am, I'm just too busy, I think. But if I could have the time to do it more, is there certain things, Jason, that are on the horizon for this year? Are there any new rules or restrictions or things that I should be aware of? Because I am a novice fisherman, I want to get into it more, but these are some things I want to definitely know about, because I don't want somebody coming up to my boat that looks like they're official in some matter, and I end up getting a ticket.
Well, you know, that's a very good point, and that's why if you go on to the Saskatchewan government website, saskatchewan.ca/fishing, you can go download the guide and read up on all those regulations. I mean, most of them are fairly straightforward. There's not a ton of changes year to year, but there's usually one or two tweaks in there. Maybe a lake closure, maybe an extended season, maybe a shortened season, that type of thing. For example, some lakes have very specific limits. I think of the reservoir system up by Saskatoon, like I'm talking Blackstrap, and some of those lakes have reduced limits. And the reason is because there's lots of people fishing them, and you need to let more fish go so there's enough fish for everybody. Buffalo Pound by Regina, for example, has reduced limits on perch, for example, for the same reason. Yeah, lots of anglers, that type of thing. Tobin Lake has, barbless hooks, again, because it's a trophy fishery. People go there to catch a 10-pound walleye and a 20-pound pike, so those limits or those restrictions are in place to make fish easier to release. So it's things like that you really want to keep an eye on, and then there's the general do's and don'ts that are in that angling guide as well. So that'd be the best sort of answer to that one is do a little bit of reading. It's a good read. There's pictures and everything, so it's not like a super hard 500-page document. It's a little over 30 pages.
500. So be a lot.
So there you go.
Well, because Jason Matterty is so good at catching fish, he gets the Sports Cage Clutch Performance Award, brought to you by Nick Service in Emerald Park, your local Massey Ferguson, Challenger, Rogator, Gleaner, and Fent dealer. Call 781-1077. I want to talk to you, Jason, coming from the fish perspective. Because, I mean, we've talked about all this technology. Now, fishing is allegedly a sport here. And you got cameras, you've got ultrasound, you've got, I don't know what you've got, everything under the sun. I mean, is this fair to the fish? I mean, he's getting the short end of the stick, Jason.
I was wondering if you're gonna go there, Don, and say, this is unfair for the fish.
This should be
some type of regulations. We talked about salary caps and all this. This is like, there's got to be a technology cap here, because the technology
That's
is
right.
growing faster than the fish's brains are. And Jason, this doesn't seem fair.
Well, you talk about some of the different scanning sonar where the newest technology, you can actually see a fish come up to your bait and turn on the bait and all those types of things. And it's creating quite a bit of a talky type of controversy, particularly stateside in some of these bigger tournaments, where they mm-hmm. have big money tournaments, like several thousand dollars if you win. So it's a really interesting debate. I will say this, though. At the end of the day, you have to figure out what you're out there for. Like if you're a competitive fish tournament fisherman, which, if you want to do that, that's totally fine. We generally aren't. I just go to relax and enjoy life. Like you have to decide how deep you want to get into the technology, how much you can afford, that type of thing. But even with all this technology, and if you're using it all, you still have to figure out a way to make that fish decide they want to eat your bait and clamp down on that bait. Doesn't matter how much tech, there's basically a few simple recipes.
need to figure out, what do I want to fish for? So let's just say I want to go fishing for walleyes. Then I set up my sonar and all these things, scan what I think are walleyes. I see them on the bottom. And then I fish for them. And if I catch them, okay, well, that's great. The sonar showed me where they were, how far they were off the bottom, if they're in 10 feet of water or if they're in 20, that type of thing. But I still have to figure out how to make them bite. So I think they're still the ultimate deciders, you know, in terms of whether or not they want what I'm offering or not. And it's crazy because some days you go out and you think you're all hot stuff and they're hitting everything you throw at them. And then you decide to throw your buddy Don in the boat and say, oh, they did this yesterday. Well, guess what? They're not doing it today. You know, so,
no, that's,
so
right.
That's kind of the real appeal, I think, too, to this sport is just when you think you got it figured out, Mother Nature hands it to you. You know, just kind of like if you're in football or hockey, you gotta stay focused, and you gotta not get too high, and you gotta not get too low.
Now, some of the best holidays, probably the same as you, Jason, maybe you as well, Derek, I've ever had on fishing trips is in the provinces north. I remember one paddling down the Churchill River that really stands out in my memory. I'll never forget it. An amazing experience. And tell me if you agree with this, Jason. I mean, is northern Saskatchewan one of the most underrated places on earth to fish?
Well, you know, I would extend that to say the whole province in some ways is too. But let's start with the north. Absolutely, I agree. And the reason is because you have this, the angler-to-fish ratio is tilted heavily in terms of the fish. And what I mean by that is, there are more fish than anglers that you're going to see out there. You know, so lots of times you go up north to those places, it's trees, water, and fish, and maybe a couple of buddies. And that's what I love about the north, is you have this sort of, how many anglers have been here, this feeling of pristine wilderness and all those different things. Now, having said that, lots of people don't realize you go to a Diefenbaker, you go to a Blackstrap, a Buffalo Pound, the Qu'Appelle Lakes. There's phenomenal fishing everywhere in this province, and even though the water might get a little muddy or green in the summer, there's still great fishing everywhere in this province. And I don't think a lot of people realize that on the prairie, where you see land forever, there's gold mines of fishing even there.
That is so cool. I'll check out Jason Manity on getfishing.ca. He's always has so much information on the sport of fishing in the province of Saskatchewan. Thank you, Jason, for joining Derek and I. Sports Cage continues in just a moment.
The all-new Sports Cage is brought to you by Busy Bee Doors. Busy Bee will repair or replace your residential or commercial garage door so you don't get stuck in or out. Catch the buzz. Busy Bee Doors, the garage door specialists. Don't miss a minute of the all-new Sports Cage. Podcasts are posted at sportscage.com. 620 CKRM.
And
the all-new Sports Cage is brought to you by Nick's Service in Emerald Park, your local Massey Ferguson, Challenger, Rogator, Gleaner, and Fendt dealer. Call 781-1077.
I'll say, and one more time.
We're excited. You know what? We're excited for the final segment.
That's right. And we're going to have Cody Jansen on right away. You know, the Sports Cage Clutch Performance, I did give it to Jason Manity. It's now a tie between Jason Manity, because he's so prolific at catching fish, and Jamal Murray, Derek, who made that crazy shot to beat the Lakers. You know, a buzzer beater, and he fell into the corner. I mean, it's sort of like Kawhi Leonard did in 99 for the Raptors, didn't you think? Sort of.
About the same spot. And, of course, there's that Canadian connection in both. For Kawhi Leonard, it was for the Toronto Raptors and our lone NBA team, of course. And then in this case, it's Jamal Murray, one of our many and growing number of great NBA basketball players that are Canadian. But that was great to see. They probably didn't deserve to win that game. Well, maybe they did. You could argue that, you know, that they were that they deserved to win because they fought back and they ended up overcoming a 20-point deficit. But for most of the game,
yeah,
they didn't look like they deserved to win it, and then they sure turned it on. So and very exciting play. He hits it in the corner, the same spot that Kawhi Leonard did, and then he kind of falls down. And yeah, AD, Anthony Davis is right around him. They kind of all shove him out of the way, and they pick up Jamal Murray, and everybody's ecstatic, and Denver's rejoicing. So that's a tough one. It's a tough one probably to bounce back from. I heard the Lakers coach after that game just talking about that they got to forget about it. But that one stings. That one hurts because you're just victory just snatched away from you right at the end. But definitely worthy of the clutch performer. I think that's a good choice.
Well, I ran up because we needed to run the commercial break or the commercial intro, and we had to go to a tie because I forgot. So you have to always move along and be flexible. You know, I mean, they've got to get Jamal Murray on the Olympic team, do they not, Derek? I mean, nothing's been said about Jamal Murray, but, let's keep our fingers crossed that he's in Paris.
Well, you talk about a clutch performer. You talk about somebody that's been there before. You talk about somebody that knows what it takes to win. In the case of the NBA Finals, of course, you could look at it like the Olympics. They got to, you know, get through a, you know, instead of the regular season, it's some round robin games, and then you get to the playoffs, and then you got to persevere and be there in the end. It's a lot shorter of a quest, of course, than winning the NBA Finals, but still, you have to have somebody that has been there before, knows what it takes, and is a great leader. And you talk about a clutch performer. I don't know, after seeing that shot yesterday, I'd be quite fine if they give the ball to Jamal Murray when Canada finds themselves, you know, with just a few seconds left and they need a bucket to win or a bucket to tie. I'd be quite fine if their game plan going into that is to get it to Jamal Murray. So, yes, I definitely hope Donnie's there and will be another one of those Canadian basketball players that we're just getting so excited about and looking forward to seeing what they can do as a team, as a whole, at the Olympics this year for sure.
Absolutely. Cody Jansen, the play-by-play person for the NLL's Saskatchewan Rush, now joins Derek and I. Now, Cody, unfortunately, the Rush season ended Saturday night with a really gut-wrenching loss. How do you see the Rush season that was?
Yeah, I think it's tough the way it went down, right? No one wants to see your season come to a close on the final game, and even worse, you know, with a few minutes left to go in your final home game of the season when you're tied and it's your former star player who puts it to bed. So I think that there is a bit of a bitter taste in that sense. But I think if you look over the season as a whole, and especially, you know, the last two-thirds of the season, I think in general it's a lot more of a positive outlook compared to the previous seasons where, you know, you miss the playoffs and it's a very negative outlook because the future wasn't bright. At the time, it was a lot of aging players who, you know, they were moving further away from their prime than closer to their prime. So I do think the outlook in Saskatchewan still very positive. There's a lot of guys who are still on the up and up. But unfortunately, yeah, that Toronto loss is going to sting for a little while.
Yeah, Cody, I was at that game, as you know. Thanks, Cody, for getting me a couple of tickets to attend that one. I wanted to be there in person so I could see what the crowd was like, what the feeling was like, and I was right there biting my nails all the way through. Unfortunately, the Saskatchewan Rush come up just a goal short. The other one that we can laugh about it now because, you know, we've had a chance to kind of think about the season that was and move forward, and we're going to keep this all on a positive. But I was like, they're great players, too, by the way. Chris Corbeil, Mark Matthews, Dan Littner, just these three. You guys, the Rush, are a classy bunch, of course, and they had little tribute videos to these former Rush players up on the screen. And then I was like, then you guys go and knock our Rush out. What the heck? That's no way of saying thank you for these tribute videos we put up there for you. But that's just obviously in jest. It was a good, solid finish for the Rush, I think, Cody, because I think a lot of people wrote them off a lot earlier. I got a buddy of mine that's an assistant coach on the Calgary Roughnecks, and him and I were talking and kind of arguing back and forth about who's going to be there in the end. Of course, he's talking about Calgary. I'm talking about the Rush. And it seemed that, you know, at least he did, and a couple other teams probably, it seemed like were probably thinking that the Rush were not going to be in the mix maybe later in the year. But they were there right to the end, only came up a couple of goals short of winning it and advancing. So I think a very positive end to the season for the Rush looking towards next season, wouldn't you?
Absolutely, right? And starting 1-4, not ideal. But the way that they were able to turn it on, and again, you're one game away from the playoffs. You're tied for that last playoff spot, essentially. And you're saving a goal away from making the playoffs. Yeah, you got to be pretty optimistic with that, especially, you know, considering at one point this team was, you know, 5-8, 6-9, with three games left to go to the in the season, and it really could have got super ugly. And instead, I think they kind of had a little bit of a gut check time and showed what was really their potential.
In lacrosse, much like hockey, we're talking about the NHL playoffs, and earlier to kick off the show, we had former NHL great. Never mind just an NHL great. We'll just say just a great communicator, too. And Brian Skrudland, he filled up an hour with us, Cody. Had some great stories and great insight into the NHL playoffs. And one of the things he spoke about, an NHL Stanley Cup champion team has to have, is great goaltending. I would say the same in the National Lacrosse League, because a goalie, of course, can steal a game from you here and there. And, in fact, they can just give that confidence to the team that starts at the last line of defense, that starts in goal, and it just resonates out into the whole team. If you can have a goalie that can do that for you, it can give a team such confidence. So I think a great goaltender is a key to success in the National Lacrosse League. I would say the Rush have one that they can build on for the future, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely, right? And you got Frank Siliano locked up for another year. That's absolutely massive, right? That's why you go out and get him from San Diego. And that's also why it gives Derek Keenan the confidence to move up a guy like Thomas Kysak as well, right? So Frank Siliano, his last three starts against Calgary, San Diego, and Toronto, three of the better teams in the National Lacrosse League, and he's posting an .810 save percentage. So, yeah, he dialed it in when he needed to be. Yeah, I would say the game in Calgary, you know, prior to the home game, wasn't his best by any means. But I also think that it's bound to happen in lacrosse. It's very rare you can find a goalie who will give you 15 to 17 A-plus starts. But I think if you get that quality 12 to 14 starts out of a guy like Frank Siliano, you should make the playoffs. And everyone knows, once you make the playoffs in the NLL, anyone's got a shot. And talking with, you know, some of those guys that you previously mentioned who aren't on the Rush anymore, their very first thing that they're saying is, thank goodness we don't have to play that team in playoffs, right? No one in their right mind wanted to see Saskatchewan if the Rush made the playoffs. They way rather face a Rochester or a New York or a Panther City, because they weren't peaking at the right time. Saskatchewan was peaking right at the end, and that was a little bit scary, especially when you got a hot goaltender like Frank Siliano.
One of the keys to moving forward and having a team carry forward success, of course, is to know when to cut ties with aging players. It's nothing against any player in any league, in any sport, male or female, but everybody has a lifespan. And what you want to do as a general manager, of course, is figure out when they're just right at their best, but you know next year is when they're going to start to decline, and you want to maybe move them on right when that starts to happen. I would never second guess anything Derek Keenan decides in pro lacrosse, because he's forgotten, as people say, hear this a lot, he's forgotten more about lacrosse than I will ever know. I mean, he would have such a vast knowledge and such an experience with these players, and know these signs when people start to, you know, show that they're going to start declining in their career. Well, the Rush moved on from these players, and maybe some of these players, it was also because maybe they want to be closer to home, and there's other factors that go into it. I know with Chris Corbeil and Mark Matthews being from out east, but talk about the young players that the Rush have as we look to turn the page and start a new chapter and move forward with these young guys. There's a lot of young guys that really should have the Rush faithful excited, because they had brilliant career years this year, and it seems very bright for them in their future.
Yeah, and the one thing about pro sports is it's a profession, not a job, right? You can hold a job until you're 60, 70, and no one bats an eye. But if it's a profession, right, they're looking for you in your peak, and so they're going to move on for you when they're done with you. And I think that's kind of where Saskatchewan was at, is you can't really have a bunch of aging players and not be making the playoffs, right? If those guys are on the back nine and they're not, you know, taking you to a championship, you're not doing your job. And I think that's why Derek Keenan felt the need to shake it up and bring in guys like Zach Manns, Adam J. I mean, let's just consider this. You've seen plenty of lacrosse. Both of you two have. There's only been two Saskatchewan teams ever have three or more forwards with 80-plus points, and this year was one of them. The other time was 2018, when the Rush walked all over the league and then beat Rochester in three games to win their third championship in 4 years. So I think if anyone's worried about the offense, that probably should be last on the worrisome list, because this team does have a lot of players coming into their own. Ryan Keenan, former first overall draft pick, now a captain of the team, hit the 90-point mark. Robert Church, third time in his career, he hit the 100-point mark. Clark Walter, a career year, almost 50 points for him. Mike Triolo had a hat trick against Toronto. There's a lot of those players who... They took big steps this year, and that's the positive part, is that if you can feel the team getting better, you're happy with that. Jake Boudreau is going to get votes for Defender of the Year, Transition Player of the Year. He's that good. 9 goals, 18 assists, 132 loose balls, 25 caused turnovers. I mean, he's an absolute machine, and he's only in his second year of pro lacrosse, so he's only going to get better. Ryan Barnabal, Jared Smith, there's a lot of that young talent, and I think that's the most encouraging part of it. It's at all positions. It's forwards, it's defense, and between the pipes, I know it did rub people the wrong way when you see Lane Rischka, a local product, get moved down to the practice roster. But guys, I'm telling you, this Thomas Kaizik kid that they've got between the pipes, he's only 19 years old. He's got 2 years of junior lacrosse left that he'll play over summers. He's the real deal. He is so fun to watch. He's so good in practice. He basically forced the team's hand to move him up. He was that good, and they're that confident in him. That and just the praise he gets from guys like Evan Kirk and a lot of high-end NLL goaltenders talking about his potential. You know, the future of goaltending and defense and forwards on this team are all in really good hands. Even with the draft prospects coming in, you got Josh Sawada, one of the best forwards in the country, playing at Duke right now. They could win a national championship this year. You got Levi Anderson, just eclipsed 200 points in the NCAA ranks. He's gone to a Minto Cup. He went to a President's Cup last year with the Miners. There's a lot of good players coming in. I think people are... I don't think they're going to be as shocked next year when the Rush are better, but they're going to take a big step forward.
You know, lacrosse and the history of lacrosse is absolutely amazing in Canada. It predates every sport other than our last segment, maybe fishing. I think fishing was number one in Canada, maybe lacrosse number two, because the game of lacrosse, I had to look it up, Cody and Derek, but it was first played in Canada in 1683. 1683 for lacrosse. Mm. And, of course, the Europeans brought it over. They introduced it to indigenous folks. And it's mind-boggling, the history it has. Of course, it's the national summer sport. Hockey's the national winter sport in Canada. We have two national sports, lacrosse and hockey. So it's like it's great. The leagues, like NLL, is having a renaissance of late. I mean, the two fastest growing leagues in North America are the National Lacrosse League and Major League Soccer, MLS. And of course, we all know 15 teams in the NLL, 9 in the U.S., 6 in Canada currently, with Ottawa, of course, gaining a franchise. So it's really exploding, isn't it, Cody? What do you think this league's has going for? Like, why the growth, especially in the last couple of years?
Well, again, I think that there's so much history to it, right? Like, you track back all lacrosse's history, and again, you know, with the indigenous tribes playing it back in the 12th century. I know it was called stickball back then. It looked a little bit different, and yeah, it was modernized a little bit later on when, you know, some of the Europeans came over, and those settlers, you know, kind of helped evolve the sport into what it is. But again, it does have that much history, and I think it resonates with that many people, that it just continues to tell a story. And that's what a lot of people do like about it. That's one of the coolest things when we get to go to schools around Saskatchewan and talk about the game. Those are always the questions that students from all over ask about it. So there's a lot of really cool connections with it. And then you see just the way that it's evolved, the history from the Man Cup and the Minto Cup, those are early 1900s trophies, until the NLL Cup, which is obviously, it's followed the MILL, the Eagle Pro Box Lacrosse League. There's actually a lot of history that people maybe don't know about because it's a lot newer, especially in Saskatchewan. Look, I grew up in south of Swift Current. There was zero lacrosse played where I was from. I was the only kid, probably 100-mile radius, that had a lacrosse stick. But to see the team move from 2016 in Saskatchewan, see it grow, I think lacrosse has really taken steps up. Once it moved out of its traditional areas, once it, BC and Ontario are the hotbeds, but to see it grow and take that next step, it had to step out of its comfort zone. And that's why I think it's really growing, is because it's expanding to new areas and new people can fall in love with the game.
Cody, so in a year in review, if we will call it that, before we let you go here, talk about what would be some of the highlights for you in this year for the Saskatchewan Rush. Unfortunately, they didn't make the postseason, but as we said, they started off slow, finished very strong, which is very good to go into next season. We would obviously rather that they finish strong than start off strong and finish slow. So they finished strong. We're optimistic for next year. What's something from this past season that you would, call a highlight if you're able to reflect on it?
I think the highlight is the, game a couple of weeks ago against San Diego. You're playing the second best team in the league that's coming into town looking to stick it to you because there's a rivalry that runs deep with a lot of those players on the floor. And you've got the likes of Dane Doby, Austin Stotts, Wes Bird, Kyle Rubish coming to town. And the Rush, they go and beat them by five. That's a pretty big whooping right there for a team that's out of the playoffs to go and handle a second-place team like that. So I would say that's probably one of the season highs, if not beating Calgary. Look, it had been a long time since the Rush had beaten Calgary at home. It was over 2,000 days. Like, that's a long period of time that some of the old guard just wasn't able to get it done. And so now you bring in some of those new faces, the fresh blood that they've got their legs underneath them and they got a little bit more confident. And now all of a sudden, you're not the whipping boy in the Battle of the Prairies, right? That's a good feeling for the Rush, knowing that you got that monkey off of your back. And then again, I just think that, the Rush winning three of their last four home games really sets this team up for success going into next year, because the fans truly got to see what this team's about, because those first five games of the year, that wasn't the Saskatchewan Rush lacrosse team. Look, I know, seven of their 10 losses were by a goal or two, right? And, there's one that was a three-goal game, and there was a couple of empty netters in the Halifax games. I consider those anomalies. I think that's just one team that was a bit of the Rush's kryptonite all season long. And maybe, they had Frank Shiliano's number in two of his starts. But I think the all-around optimism just comes from this team consistently getting better and returning basically everyone they want, right? There's very few and far between who I don't expect to see back. Again, I guess Mike Messenger is probably the one who's not under contract for next year, that they're going to have to get something figured out there or whatever happens this summer. But you got Church signed next year, Keenan signed next year, Shiliano, Manns, Walter. Like, you've got a lot of really dang good players here. And you've got five draft picks in the first two rounds of this upcoming draft. So you've either got the opportunity to continue to stock the cupboards, or if you want to go make a run next year, you've got the perfect trade chips. And I think this Rush team is likely going to be adding some of those more impactful players. And I really think that the future is bright because they hold that.
Cody Jansen, the voice of the Saskatchewan Rush, joining here for our last segment here on Sports Cage. Cody, so you won't be calling any games, unfortunately, for this season, as the Saskatchewan Rush were eliminated from the postseason by just one goal. It was heartbreaking on the weekend by the Toronto Rock. But what's next on the to-do list? Continue to work on signing those guys that need to be signed, like you said, making moves as far as the team goes. I would assume continue to grow the game of lacrosse in the province as well, because if it's popular with the kids, It's going to be popular with the parents, and that's going to be a next generation thing, and more people will continue to come. So I assume there's work to be done in the front office and also work to be done in the community as well.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about the Rush organization and the new ownership with that, right, is they're huge on that. Like tonight, there's still some guys living locally after the season sticking around. We're going to lacrosse practices this evening in Saskatoon. Like they want to be here. They want to help out. They want to be in the community. That's super great to see. And obviously, as a lacrosse person, I love it because it does grow the game. It helps out that next generation. From a team perspective, yeah, free agency is the next thing that's going to come up here in August. Again, the team's got to get new contracts done, GM, head coaching-wise. But again, a lot of those main players are already under contract, so I don't expect a ton to happen in that regards. Maybe there's a free agent or two that they do target. I know that there's a couple of big names going to be out there, but I think a lot of it's looking towards the draft and deciding what's the next play. Like, you know, you've got Anderson and Zawada coming in, so who do you move out? Who do you add? And do you draft five players in the first two rounds? Because where are they going to go, right? The NLL is a bit of an anomaly where there's no feeder system yet. And it's the craziest part about the league is that you can keep players on your draft list. You can move them to your practice roster. You can keep them around. But if there's an opportunity to better your team, add that next level player who's going to help this team get into the playoffs and win a couple of rounds, you got to think that there's that opportunity or that interest from a coaching and management side, especially because ownership knows getting into the playoffs is what this fan base deserves, and that's clearly the goal for next year.
Now, the biggest team sports in Canada and the U.S., likely baseball, hockey, basketball, football. I'm watching the NLL, and I think the same thing every time. These athletes playing in the NLL are hugely underrated athletes, probably because they're not in that big four sports category, Cody. I mean, these guys, they chose lacrosse, and if they would have chosen hockey, some of them would be in the NHL. If they would have chosen football, some of them would have been in the CFL. Isn't that right? Like, these guys are very athletic, and they've got the athletic skills and the toughness that you see in these other sports just as much as anybody that's making millions of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, the hockey and lacrosse runs way deep, right? You think about Wayne Gretzky, Brendan Shanahan, all those guys being super good lacrosse players, Adam Oates, even Brandon Montour. Now, you know, the Panthers, he goes on a run. He also won a Minto Cup in 2017 with Holden Garland to the Saskatchewan Rush, right? So there's a lot of crossover with the hockey, lacrosse. I think team sport-wise, the most interesting thing is that we have this certain perception of sports because we watch at the highest level, right? Football, we watch the NFL. Hockey, we watch the NHL. You know, basketball, you watch the NBA. Baseball, you watch the MLB. Those are all the top leagues in their sport, and Saskatchewan doesn't have that. Saskatchewan has the NLL, and that's as good as it gets for lacrosse. So you can go and watch junior, senior, summer ball, college ball, whatever it is, anywhere. But you get to witness the best of the best players in Saskatchewan every weekend, you know, during the NLL season. And that's the cool part, is it doesn't get better than those, you know, 17 guys suiting up for the Saskatchewan Rush. That I think is a really underrated aspect, is you are watching the best athletes in their profession, and that's, you know, the best lacrosse players in the world.
They are, and it's a great sport, and good luck to the Saskatchewan Rush next season. Cody, that's it for Sports Cage. On behalf of myself, Don Hewitt, and Derek Bidwell in Saskatoon, I wish everybody a nice and good evening.